is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us on The Conversation. It is Monday, July 29th. The future of our Honolulu, Hawaiʻi, now is your chance to weigh in on plans to guide development in the urban core, help our city leaders decide on issues important to you. We learn more about planning for fire disasters across the state, why access roads and clearing back brush from neighborhoods prone to fires are so important to communities at risk. And the proposed Keoho Bay management plan on the Big Island has many community members taking sides. We hear from a historic site caretaker, also a small business owner, on why the plan is needed. Plus, we take a closer look at marine protected areas, the upside for fishermen. This is A Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Our Honolulu, care about its future? Well, then this is the time to give your input about its development that will guide policy decisions on how to spend taxpayers' money. Tomorrow kicks off a series of community meetings to gather feedback on the development plans for the urban core. It affects close to about 500,000 people. This morning, we talked to Honolulu Council member Esther Kiaina. She's the chair of the Committee on Planning and the Economy. These meetings are the first time the council is extending its reach into the affected neighborhoods in addition to the traditional public hearings.
This is a development plan that is the largest, impacts the largest number of people on Oahu, which is 440,000 people, right? And it stretches from Kahala to Pearl City. It impacts five council districts, as well as nearly 20 neighborhood boards. And so it's massive. And as a result, we're not just considering it before the committee, we're actually going out into the community so that we can drill down into specific neighborhoods.
So this is really an opportunity for all of us to have our two cents and have a say. And if they weren't able to get to the council hearings down there at Honolulu Hale, this is coming to their area, to their neighborhood.
That is correct. And also, I do need to say that the city's Department of Planning and Permitting did have extensive hearings. But now that the plan has officially been submitted to the city, we needed to make sure, because of its impacts, right, with regard to planning and funding investments, we felt that it was important for the council members whose districts were impacted that they actually go out into the communities and hear from the communities directly, not just at Honolulu Hale. So that was the whole purpose for this.
And this is everything from, what, transportation to housing to resiliency?
Yes, it actually focuses, for this one specifically, this focuses on land use and housing, transportation, economic development, environmental sustainability, and community livability. So it's very wide-ranging, right? And what the primary urban center development plan does is it actually implements the policy directions given from the general plan, of course, right?
Yes. And for folks, you know, who know this whole land use thing, I mean, it's everything from, you know, that whole movement to keep country to, you know, to control growth, you know, in certain areas. And it's really the community's vision for what they want to see for their area.
Absolutely. And what this plan will help, as the other plans for the other regions, it informs the city, both the administration and the city council, with regard to our investments or changes to zoning laws, what we provide for infrastructure in the budget, and what we do to update our city codes and standards. And I think most importantly, you know, we have different plans like the Transient Oriented Development Neighborhood Plan. We have the City Oahu Resiliency Strategy, or the Climate Action Plan. And of course, we have the primary governing document for our zoning laws is land use, our land use ordinance. And my committee, the Committee on Planning and the Economy, is actually doing a major overhaul of the land use ordinance through Bill 64, 2023. And in August, we're going to be taking a look at agricultural use. And so all of these developed development plans and sustainable communities plans, which trickle down from the general plan, is so important for communities as they look over the next 25 years.
You've got the Wanalua High School meeting tomorrow, you know, and then there's Kaimuki later in August, as well as Leeward Community College and Kawana Nakoa. But let's just kind of walk down some of these regions, like, you know, Kalihi through Waimalu. I mean, we're talking, like you said, the impact of the transit, you know, development, you know, in those areas, right?
Yeah.
Along Dillingham, that kind of thing.
Oh, absolutely. Well, it's downtown Honolulu. It's Waikiki. It's the industrial area about around Honolulu International Airport, around that area. There's so much going on here that you have old-time neighborhoods. You have new neighborhoods, of course, in Kaka'ako, right? It's such a wide breadth geographically and a mixture of various types of neighborhoods. To me, this plan is one of the most important plans that impacts all of the people of Oahu.
We're also talking about the development by the Aloha Stadium, right?
And oh, absolutely. Just to give you an example, okay, so first of all, I told you there were five council districts. Let me just tell you how expansive this is, even just for tomorrow's hearing, right? This is Councilmember Radiant Cordero's district, which is District 7. It impacts Kapalama Kai, Kalihi Kai, Kahauiki, Maolioloa, that's Sand Island, Mapunapuna, Moku Maukawea, Moanalua, Salt Lake, the airport, Aliamanu, Red Hill, Hickam, Halawa, Aiea, right? Ford Island, Kalaoao, Waimalu. It's huge. That's just one of the city council districts that it impacts. So again, I told you, it's five city council districts, right? It stretches from Kahala to Pearl City, and it impacts nearly 20 neighborhood boards. Just to give you an example, for our Ko'olaupoko, that's my district. I'm the only council district impacted by that, the Ko'olaupoko sustainability plan. And so it all differs based on the district. I think Councilmember Wire, whose district is massive, right? It's he includes North Shore, Kahalu'u, all the way up to Waihiwa, right? And part of down to Waipio. His, I believe, has three sustainable communities plans that are impacted, whereas mine is only one. So mm-hmm. I'm just saying that this specific plan needs to be vetted by all communities, because even if there were a lot of hearings held, for me, because it's so important to the future planning of, growth in the area and measured development, I think that it's so important for communities to be heard.
And the meeting in the Kaimuki area, that's Ala Moana through Kahala, and I know one issue that is of high interest is, you know, the recent law that was passed to encourage more affordable housing and to allow more density in some of the older neighborhoods. So will people be able to give their two cents about that?
The plans are to provide guidance as well. You're drilling down into the land use ordinance, mm-hmm. which we are considering before the committee under Bill 64. So again, as I stated, there are different tiers of land use planning for the district, I mean, for the city. And of course, that's first the general plan. There's eight development and sustainable community plans. And then what happens is then the city drills down further into a third tier, and that involves what I just mentioned. It's implementing all of these plans through land use ordinances, the capital improvement programs, for example, and functional plans. So with regard to the density bill that was recently passed by the state legislature, we are dealing with that within the Bill 64 2023. And if you're not aware, you know, the Honolulu City Council had expressed concern over that act because it required two ADUs to be built. It allowed two ADUs on top of single family home. And what we did in the committee is that I queried all of the council members present on the committee, and we felt that the proper balance was to require one ohana unit and one accessory dwelling unit. And the difference, of course, is that when you have two ADUs, they need not be related. And so if you're truly trying to help multi-generational families, then requiring an ohana unit, which you have to be related to, we felt incentivizes families to stay here in Hawaii, and it actually deters outside investors. Our belief is that in downtown areas like Kaimuki, for example, under the current state law that is directing cities to require to ADUs, what would happen is people are going to go into neighborhoods, buy up the properties, build a new single-family home as well as two ADUs so that they could maximize the return on investment that they pay for the property. And so what the Honolulu City Council has done is it has struck a balance to deter that type of outside investment. And so, again, we are requiring or allowing for an Ohana unit to be built in addition to a accessory dwelling unit. And so you can have a family member there. They can live in the other unit, or you could rent it to someone who is in need of a long-term rental. And, of course, we would prefer that that go to local families.
And then for the Leeward meeting, are there any particular issues that are top of mind from IAEA through Pearl City?
You know, I haven't drilled down into each of the specific issues.
But as far as just the general thought that this does impact, you know, the urban core in so many ways, and that really people just need to get involved and learn about what could happen in their districts and to give their input.
And what I would say that we did not talk about at length is about the transient-oriented development neighborhood plans, and all through IAEA, all the way downtown, they will be impacted. And so the question, of course, is as we try to promote affordable housing and economic development, we, of course, encourage that it happen along the corridors of the rail.
Yes, because we are seeing, you know, some developers come in with ideas, whether it's Kamehameha Schools out in Waipahu or the development, you know, downtown on Kapi'olani Boulevard there, you know, in the Mo'ili'ili area. I know folks are concerned about that. And a lot of the state land is along the rail route, and there is a push to be able to develop those if we can and put up housing.
Absolutely. And so I think that the good news is at the city and state level, as well as our federal congressional delegation, we are united in making sure that we could increase the availability of affordable housing and economic development along the rail corridor. And I think that's something we can all work on collectively. It not only provides housing, it spurs economic development, and of course raises tax revenues for the city and county.
And then maybe walk us through what happens once you have these hearings. What's the timetable?
So I'm hoping that the last field hearing is in September, and then I'm going to be moving. It will require me to take action on measures. So I'm hoping before the ending of the year that this resolution, this plan will be approved. And what it will do is help inform not just the city council, but also the city administration as we plan for the upcoming budgetary cycle, the type of investments needed to implement the plan.
That was Councilmember Esther Kiaina. She says the plans also include planning for resiliency when it comes to disasters like wildfires. Tomorrow's meeting is at 6 p.m. at Wanalua Library. We will have links to the other meetings planned for Kaimuki High School, Leeward Community College, and Kawananakoa Middle School on the conversation page of our website later today.
There's a new global axis of autocracy. Strong men who don't share ideology, they share a thirst for power.
The Chinese Communist Party and the Putin oligarchs aren't really for the same thing, except to the extent that, as I said, they're against us. And I suppose they're all for their own power, and they're also interested. They're all very interested in money.
Ann Applebaum says the new twist is that autocrats now work together to keep that grip on power. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
High blood pressure is the number one risk factor for death worldwide. How do you know if you have it, and what can be done about it? I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak. Join me today on The Body Show. We'll talk with an expert about the best way to control hypertension and live well. That's today at 6:30 on The Body Show.
Firefighters on the island of Hawaii are keeping a close eye this morning on hotspots remaining from a 75-acre wildfire that broke out last night in Waikoloa. The three fire companies and a helicopter responded to the flames a little after 6 o'clock last night and were able to protect structures in the area. No evacuations were ordered and the fire was contained later in the night. It is the latest reminder that we are in the middle of wildfire season around the islands. We are actually 10 days from the anniversary of the fire that devastated Lahaina and left more than 100 people dead and much of the community in ashes. This week, HPR is doing a series of stories on the lingering vulnerability of many communities to wildfires and what some have been doing to improve their situations. HPR News Director Bill Dorman joins us this morning with a closer look at this week's coverage. Good morning.
Good morning. Aloha, Catherine. You know, and yes, we're heading into a difficult period with thoughts of those who, of course, lost family, friends, and neighbors last summer and who've suffered other losses and pain and hardship, many who of whom continue to suffer. And for the past year, you've heard Catherine Kulipaktil's excellent reporting that's continued from Maui. Other reporters, Kuvehi Hiraishi, Cassie Ordonio, recently you've heard Catherine's stories on fears and anxiety sparked by those recent fire outbreaks upcountry in Maui. And over the last few weeks, two of our other reporters have been on the ground in different locations around the state, and they're looking specifically at risk, community risk, and actions that are being taken or planned or talked about when it comes to wildfires. Ashley Mizuo just got back from a reporting trip following up on the recent outbreak of fires in the west side of Kauai. She's also spent time on the west side of Oahu looking at some very specific issues communities are focusing on there. She'll be here actually to talk to you in more detail later this week, but also looking into vulnerabilities of Kupuna. Again, something we tragically saw in Lahaina, of course, and others are looking around. That has been such an impact around the state. Savannah Harriman-Pote spent some time recently on her home turf of Hawaii Island and was actually in Waikoloa. She'll be with you later this week also to talk about some particular actions and community cooperation, really, that's going on in that area. And today it's Savannah who's starting our series with a piece that takes a broader overview look, really, at some of the challenges that are shared around the islands. There's topography and population patterns that have shifted in recent years, change in landscape, of course, going back to plantation days, invasive grasses. But one theme that emerged definitely after the Lahaina fire, this idea of escape routes. Part of that just was in Lahaina, people trapped. If you look around the state, there are areas that are vulnerable but have limited access. And in some cases, there's one way in and one way out. And as part of Savannah's piece today, she reports that that's a situation for about 20% of the developed communities in Hawaii, that one way in, one way out. Ed Sniffen, state transportation director, says that if we would build all the needed access roads around the state for emergency routes, that would be about $2 billion. And there are some modifications that certain communities have been focusing on short of building new roads. You'll hear more of that this week. But also, it's not the only area that folks are focusing on. We can also learn from other communities that have suffered through wildfires. As we speak right now, some 5,000 firefighters working on that Park Fire in California. It's an area greater than the size of Los Angeles now. It's staggering. Stephen Wong works with a team of researchers at the University of Alberta in Western Canada, and that area has been hit as well. They just had a fire that destroyed about a third of the town of Jasper. And Wong says it's crucial to look not only at the physical aspects of infrastructure and roads and routes, but also people's behavior.
The ability of infrastructure to move people is only half the equation. The other half that is really critical is how people behave. For example, in an evacuation, it's really important to know when people are going to depart. If everyone decides to depart all at the same time, you can imagine that there's going to be a lot of vehicles on the roadway all at the same time. You can also see that on the flip side, that if people take a really long time to depart, the wildfire may come and impact people as they're trying to leave. So there's different components, but behavior presents a really key challenge to this.
Yeah, we saw that with the tsunami, right?
A few years ago,
how there was gridlock on Oahu.
Oh, disaster of any kind. And it is sort of human nature when you think about it. And there's that element of panic that sets in. But then how do you forestall that? One of those thoughts is that human behavior can be learned, can be changed. And in Hawaii, certainly, talk about a big shift in how wildfires have been thought of. You know, even a tsunami warning used to be, oh, get to Mauka and that's it. Now, wildfires as a factor in building roads, in community developments, all of that. You know, Stephen Wong says that combination of education and communication has been effective in wildfire disasters, and it needs to be a critical part also of community strategies.
I think this is where cost-effective operational strategies using our existing infrastructure can be really important. And part of that does come with education. It involves understanding the demand on roadways from evacuees and evacuee behavior. But often these fixes can be much cheaper to implement, but still just as effective, perhaps even more effective if used correctly and implemented correctly. So a key is making sure that emergency managers, as well as different officials, police, fire, are all on the same page and communicate with each other on how to implement the response in the disaster.
You know, and even Councilmember Kiaina had said, you know, we've got to make sure that our nonprofit groups that are placed in the communities, you know, they're going to play a key integral part in helping to respond to people.
And so are neighbors, property owners, this combination of community coming together. The series on wildfire vulnerability and response around the island, Savannah, Haramapo today and Thursday, including a report from Waikoloa, Ashley Mizua the rest of the week, including a report from Hanapepe, West Kauai, and an online digital component going up later today from Krista Rados and Sophia McCullough and our intern, Tori DeJournay. So all ahead during a difficult period that's going to be coming up as we look to that anniversary on the 8th.
All right. Well, looking forward to the coverage. We've been talking to HPR's news director, Bill Dorman. Tune in to HPR all week for our series on fire vulnerability around the state. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. On your way to lunch, you might want to consider ordering the dish featured in today's backyard quiz. When you go to a Korean restaurant in Hawaii, a staple that many residents enjoy is a mitjeon. According to some stories, it was created as a dish for the Korean royal court. The word jeon means fritter, and we know it as a savory pancake made with thin beef slices and covered with a soft layer of flour and eggs. It's usually served with a cup of rice and a Korean green onion salad called pache. It can include a mac salad and a sweet shoyu dipping sauce, but it also pairs well with spicier sauces, too. Now, variants of the recipes made in Hawaii usually include meat soaked in a soy sauce-based marinade, but can also be made with kimchi, scallions, or even white fish. Many locals traveling to Korea may be surprised that they'll have a difficult time finding the dish there because it's really only served in the area where it originated and goes by its Korean name. So our backyard quiz question for today, what's the Korean name for mitjeon? Call 808-941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right wins a reusable HPR tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, supporting nonprofits such as the Molokai Affordable Housing Alliance, providing Kupuna with resources for building affordable homes on Molokai. NareitHawaii.com.
On the next Fresh Air, comic Nikki Glaser talks about sex so much on stage, she says she's come to think of her privates as her publics. We'll talk about why sex is a recurring subject in her act, her self-consciousness about her body and how she looks, and what it's like writing insults for celebrity roasts. Her recent roast of Tom Brady made headlines. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3.
Support for HPR comes from Haleakala Ranch, with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to restore, maintain, and preserve the open vistas and natural beauty of Maui. More at HaleakalaRanch.com.
Kamehameha School's proposed Keoho Bay Management Plan has stirred many opinions across our community. Last week, we heard from a retired environmental attorney who took issue with some of the points in the plan's draft environmental impact statement. This morning, we received an email from listener Ben Rice that read in part, "My wife and I are retired attorneys from Santa Cruz who bought a place over 10 years ago nearby Keoho Bay. We are very concerned about Kamehameha School's determined effort to change the area into another glamorous getaway for well-to-do visitors to Hawaii." Today we hear from a Keoho resident who was impacted by the plan in more than one way. Manu Powers is the regent and president of the Daughters of Hawaii. Its members are caretakers of the birth site of King Kamehameha III. Powers is also co-owner of the snorkeling adventure company SeaQuest Hawaii, which is based near the bay's boat ramp. The Conversation's Russell Subione recently sat down with Powers to get her thoughts on the proposed plan.
So I think it's important to state I'm not a scientist. No one on the board of the Daughters of Hawaii is a scientist. And so for us, reading the draft EIS is, you know, it's a lot of jargon, but it really provides a tool for us to focus in on what our kuleana is. And in our conversations that we have had surrounding the EIS as a board, we have always come back to our mission consistently, and that is the birth site. That, speaking from a member of the Daughters of Hawaii, speaking as the president of the Daughters of Hawaii, that's our kuleana, and that's where our focus will remain. And so our job is to ensure that the birth site of Kauikeaʻoli and the surrounding area is protected, that it's highlighted, and that it's the focus of the plan. It cannot be treated as an afterthought. And unfortunately, it has for many decades felt as though the birth site itself was treated as an afterthought, as development built up around it. And so much of that is, you know, inherent to the area and not necessarily at the feet of Kamehameha Schools. There's lots of entities involved in how we got to where we are. But from the daughter's perspective, we are in support of the master plan, not necessarily speaking directly to the EIS, but where the management plan is concerned as a whole, we support the handling as it's laid out currently in plan that Kamehameha Schools has put forward to the community. As a business owner, I have concerns about runoff, but I'm assured that those concerns are going to be addressed. Traffic management, of course, but with the opening of the bypass road around the Mauka side of the bay is addressed in the plan. The bottom line is that the bay, the status quo that exists right now, is not good for the birth site. It's not good for the bay. It's not good for local people. Access is incredibly important for Native Hawaiians, for residents, for all of us, so that we can all enjoy this place and that we can all engage with it, whether we're talking about recreation or whether we're talking about cultural practices. As a resident, I would love to be able to take my children down to the bay, to be able to find a parking spot, to not feel as though we are being pushed out by the commercial operations or by any user, as a matter of fact. And the current iteration of the plan seems to address all of those concerns.
The people that I've talked to, one of the concerns that I've heard about is the idea that visitors to the Bay, whether they're local or whether they're from outside of Hawaii, there's a lot of dangerous opportunity when it comes to interacting or crossing paths with the boats that are trying to launch. And do you feel like the draft EIS will address a lot of those safety concerns that stem from the kind of congestion that's down there now?
Well, I think the bottom line is the congestion is a product of the commercial operations that are in the bay. And of course, the hotel. And hopefully, there's some people that are coming down there to visit the site where Kauikeaʻoli was born. But we know that the majority of those that are coming down are coming for commercial activity. And the issue with that is that those permits that these operators have, such as myself, were issued by the DLNR. And there's no control over that where KS is concerned. They have, you know, their kuleana and their land, and then there's the county land that is under the purview of the DLNR. And so those operators that are there are going to continue to operate with their permit legally, bring their guests down, and if they're, you know, doing what they as business owners intended to do, it's to be successful. And so that means to bring people into the bay, their point of departure. So as it stands, that traffic isn't going to change when the management plan is put into place. Then there's the next component, which is the low impact lodging. So that will bring more people down into the bay once it's constructed and in place. But KS has assured us that, you know, working with the county and working with the civic planners, the access road will address those concerns. Also, moving the parking lot away from the bay, creating parking so that parking isn't necessarily along the street on Kaleopapa there, I think that will definitely help. You'll see on a busy day, you know, July 4th weekend, cars stretching all the way back up to Ali'i Highway on Kaleopapa. So, you know, heavy, heavy congestion. The plan should address that. Again, I'm not a scientist. I'm not a civic planner. I don't know with certainty when I look at the plan if it's 100% going to eliminate those dangers you referred to. Mm-hmm. But the status quo isn't working, and there needs to be some plan in place to address the current situation so that we can hopefully, again, create access, create a more safe environment. And time will tell.
Does the proposal call for the location of your offices to be relocated somewhere else within the bay?
It does. So we have been informed that, and we've known this for years as we've reviewed the management plan, that we would be relocated to a new area, a new commercial area, closer to the hotel side of the bay. And we've been assured that that won't happen until those new spaces for commercial operators are constructed. Our space is tapped to be transitioned into a cultural and educational center. And although you would imagine that, you know, my husband and I would be alarmed or concerned about, you know, what that means for our business, you know, we were both born and raised here. For us, it's more about what's right for the bay, what's healthy for the bay. And we have a hard time finding an argument against creating a cultural educational center right in the heart of the bay. It is really primed for it. It's centrally located right by the water, right by the birth site. So we have no argument with that. We want our children and their children to be able to access the bay in an intentional and meaningful way. And it's really important to me as the president of the Daughters of Hawaii that the stories of that bay, that the story of Kauikeaʻoli is told. And what better way than to do it right there next to the birth site in a, what is already a beautiful space.
And just to clarify, when it comes to the birthplace of Kauikeaʻoli, is the Daughters of Hawaii satisfied with how the site will be treated in the proposed plan?
Currently, yes, we are. I think that there's always room for something to change, for the plan to evolve. And so it is our intention to stay in constant communication with Kamehameha Schools, something that they have facilitated throughout the process. But that will be our focus, is on the birth site itself and ensuring that the integrity of the birth site is maintained through the process, that the footprint surrounding it and that the stories told from that space and about that space are protected. We were reminded recently during a board retreat that it was a choice for Kauai Kea'uli to be born space. And so we have to honor that choice made all those many years ago and really try to understand the intentionality and the motivation there and embrace that decision and use that as sort of our North Star for communicating about the sacredness, about the importance of his legacy. And we are privileged, overwhelmed, honored, and determined, all of those things where the birth site is concerned. It's a legacy that we will have for generations. We are a long-standing organization. And if that is one of the things that we can accomplish through the lifespan of the Daughters of Hawaii, then we'll all be proud of that legacy.
Is there anything that you wanted to share about the proposal or the changes that may be coming to Kea'uli Bay?
I think it's really important to be in communication with Kamehameha Schools. I think that they've been really great about maintaining an open door policy. I know that not everyone in the community feels as though they are accessible, but we've found that they are if you go knocking. And like I said, you know, they've been engaging with us throughout the process. I think as residents and as a Native Hawaiian personally, it's really important to stay engaged in these processes. You see these signs all over Kea'uli right now saying save the bay and, you know, videos being posted online and social media posts about it. But, you know, you have to begin much earlier and then stay engaged in the process. I think that every voice should be heard, from lineal descendants to detractors to all the societies. Everyone should be involved in this. We're talking about our ali'i and we're talking about a most sacred place beyond the birth site, you know, from the springs and the water to the pali, to the cave next to the birth site. These places are significant. They deserve our attention. They deserve our attention throughout the process. And so I would encourage the public to stay engaged, to stay informed, to communicate with Kamehameha Schools and the county. And whether you're in support or whether you have concerns, it's incumbent upon all of us. It's our responsibility to share that feedback with them and with our government representatives. So engage and share feedback regularly so that you can look back on your response and the ultimate final product and know that you did everything you could to ensure that your voice was heard through the process.
Manu Powers, thanks so much for your time this morning. Really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure, Russell, always.
That was Manu Powers, head of the Daughters of Hawaii and also a small business owner of the Kea'uli Bay-based Sequest Hawaii. She was talking with HPR's Russell Subiono. August 7th is the deadline for public comment on the draft EIS for the proposed Kea'uli Bay management plan. We'll have a link to it on our website after the show.
You are invited to HPR Generation Listens Trivia Night every first Monday of the month at Village Bottle Shop and Tasting Room in Kaka'ako. Test your wits, enjoy some friendly competition, and connect with fellow HPR fans. Gather your team of up to 6 public radio nerds and sign up to play at hawaiipublicradio.org/genlisten.
Inflation, we can all pretty much define, right? Here, though, is the other thing the Federal Reserve's got to worry about, maximum employment.
It's normally defined as the highest level of employment the economy can sustain without generating higher inflation.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, Employment and Inflation, next time on Marketplace.
Beginning this evening at 6.
Now to take a look at our mailbox and hear from listeners. Following our call-in show about artificial intelligence, we got this from a listener. I seriously hope future conversations will educate the public about the absolute dangers of AI and how it systematically removes humanity from the worldwide culture, and with that removal, our connection to the natural world. Artificial intelligence is dead or death, depending on the direction we are coming from. Nothing is generated from life. It is only stolen from life and then mimicked in an artificial world for monetary gain. Monetary systems of economics are the tools of oppression and authoritarian policies. It has been proven over and over since civilization has existed. Please allow other perspectives to be discussed on what is supposed to be a balanced approach at journalism. Aloha, Ben Emery from Honoka'a on the Big Island. And Mark Inamoto shared this personal AI story. He uses something called Midjourney to experiment by using art history to generate images. For example, any painting of Chernobyl by Matisse. I am a retired designer and find the most interesting results are not trying to create reality, but by altering history. I've been working on a series of prompts that include the theme of robots painted by Francis Bacon or even Leonardo. I found the most intellectually stimulating exercises to apply history or art history to historical or contemporary events. I am also fascinated by errors generated by MJ and not in my prompt. These are some examples of my work in Midjourney. Lastly, by using historical references, I avoid any risk of copyright or plagiarism. Usually, I am seeking original images from MJ or AI. Hey, thanks for the feedback. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org or call our talkback line at 808-792-8217. Now it's time to dine in for the answer to today's backyard quiz on mijeon, the savory Korean pancake made up of pieces of thinly sliced beef covered in a layer of flour and eggs. In South Korea, recipes for the dish include steps like soaking the meat in water and then blotting the meat with paper towels. These steps are not included in Hawaii's version of the recipes. Mijeon is a staple in Korean restaurants here, but you may be surprised the dish is not popular outside of the southern Jeolla province. There they call it yukjeon, which is the answer to today's backyard quiz. For many of us locally, mijeon is one of the favorite proteins to order when putting together a Korean plate lunch, which is complete with sides of mac salad, bean sprouts, taegu, and kimchi. So don't be surprised if you weren't able to order mijeon on a trip to South Korea. This is a Hawaii thing, and we had no winners today. But that's our quiz, and if you have an idea for one to share, write to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Conserving our aquatic habitats has been a top priority for decades. Since the 1960s, the state's Division of Aquatic Resources has overseen marine protected areas, sometimes referred to as MPAs. These are areas with certain restrictions on who can visit and fish. Listeners have likely visited a few here in Hawaii. Hanauma Bay and the old Kona Airport are both examples of marine protected areas. And new research shows these restrictions are paying off in the long run. A team of researchers from the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology recently published a study in the journal Science Advances. It found that healthier reefs in these protected areas attracted bigger fish. Near Hawaii's marine reserves, anglers tended to catch a variety of larger reef fishes like ulua and o'io. The conversation's Maddie Bender spoke to two of the scientists, Elizabeth Madden and Simone Franceschini, about the study.
I believe we have four fully protected marine protected areas and marine reserves on Oahu and others throughout the state. I think Hanauma Bay is the oldest one, and that was established in 1967. And then further protections were established in the 1990s, I believe. The study was global in scope, but it certainly applies to Hawaii's marine protected areas and what we can expect to see from those.
Imagine an MPA as a safe haven or a fish sanctuary where fishing is not allowed. In this protected zone, fish can grow bigger and reproduce more. And so, like, surrounding fisheries can benefit of, like, this increased production. As concerned Hawaii, the study was focused on reef-associated fish species.
So you're finding that we're associating MPAs having been put in place with these record-breaking fish. And my first question when I saw that is, like, does that mean we should be extending MPAs? I mean, fish don't know the boundaries of that.
I think what our results show is that if we want to ensure long-term sustainable catch for future generations in Hawaii and elsewhere, we should be protecting a significant portion of our waters from fishing. And the reason why is, while that does remove some areas from fishing, if you can't fish in certain areas or you can only fish in a limited way in those areas, what it does is it sort of creates a trust fund for baby fish, or an insurance policy, you might say, where they're protected and allowed to grow and reproduce in those areas. But as you say, because they don't know the boundaries of marine reserves, as those populations within the marine reserve grow, the adults and even the larvae, their babies, spill out into nearby areas. And so it kind of allows us to have a constant source, like a fountain of fish coming out of this area. So rather than everyone fishing everywhere and depleting the fish throughout, and then there's no one to reproduce, I'm kind of exaggerating here, but instead we protect some part of the coastline where we allow those fishes to reproduce and grow, and then that creates long-term supply of fish for us to catch just outside of those areas.
Are you at all worried that the results of this study will now inspire anglers or even commercial fishermen to move some of their fishing enterprises to closer to marine protected areas?
Well, personally, I think that would be not a bad thing. I think if people can see that they're actually catching more and bigger fish near marine reserves, I think that will help people realize the value of protecting certain areas. So even though it may reduce their total area to be fished, it ensures a long-term supply of fish. So I actually think it's a great thing. It's called fishing the line, and it's commonly seen in marine reserves throughout the world where fishers cluster their behavior around marine reserve borders because intuitively or from experience, they know that that's where they're most likely to catch the fish.
Have designating any of those areas as protected been an uphill battle on the part of fisheries management researchers and conservationists, or has it been fairly easy to get public support?
No, it is not. The short answer is no. I've only been here in Hawaii for a little bit over 6 years, but I have lived in other places and followed the same patterns there. And usually here in Hawaii and elsewhere, it is not an easy thing to get marine reserves designated because, understandably, people don't want to give up areas where they are used to fishing. Until recent years, there hasn't been enough clear-cut scientific evidence to show that there are actually long-term net benefits to protecting areas in terms of what fishers will be able to catch, whether that's commercial fishers or recreational or subsistence or artisanal. And so that's why I think this study is particularly useful, because it does provide very clear-cut evidence over a global scale, including here in Hawaii, that recreational fishers will benefit from the establishment of marine protected areas, particularly over the long term. So in current and future generations.
We start to see increase in record size catches close to the MPAs after 12, mostly like 20 years after the establishment of the MPA. Why? Because, of course, we are talking about a lot of different species with different biology, different reproduction strategies. They need to eat to reproduce. However, we expect that probably this spillover effect occurs even earlier than 20 years, probably 10 or 12 years, but we can actually see it from like the data of recreational fisheries after 20 years. So 20 years lag time means that like stakeholders and managers, people that wants to see the results of the MPA, they have to be patient in terms to see natural results.
Are either of you anglers, or do either of you fish recreationally?
I have done some recreational fisheries, not here in Hawaii, but when I was in Italy or like in other parts of the world.
Have you caught anything good?
It's mostly freshwater species, like trout or salmons or some of the names. I don't know even how to translate from the Italian.
I grew up fishing in New Orleans down there, but all I ever caught was mullet. But I do remember actually, one year there was a fishing rodeo and my cousin caught the trophy size catch for our age group in mullet, and I was very disappointed because mine was smaller. But you know, that was the heyday of my fishing. So,
is there anything else that you'd want to share with listeners that they should know about this study?
I think that it really provides guidance for management agencies, conservation practitioners, and even recreational fishers about what we can expect from marine reserves and marine protected areas, which are one and the same. And I think that it's important to remember that highly protected marine ecosystems, where we do put these marine reserves and marine protected areas, they can really produce tangible, real-world, and long-term benefits for recreational fishers. And so, in my mind, it's a win-win for nature and for people. And it does sometimes take a while, but I think if we're patient, we can see the benefits of this into the future, well into the future.
That was Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology scientists Elizabeth Madden and Simone Franceschini talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. We'll have a link to their new study on our website later today. And that's it for this Monday. Tomorrow we learn more about the arrival of the ukulele here in the islands and some of the related instruments from Portugal. Got feedback for us? Please call our talkback line at 808-792-8217. You can find The Conversation as a podcast on our website or on Spotify, Apple, or Google. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.